Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. I'm one of those who is astutely observing particularly the Middle East front in that war, much in the news at the moment because of developments there that are very daunting, and of course President Obama's visit beginning today to the region, is our first guest, Joseph Klein. Joe Klein is a political journalist and author of, most recently, Lethal Engagement, Barack Hussein Obama, the United Nations and Radical Islam. He is a frequent contributor to Front Page magazine, and we'll be speaking to him momentarily about something he wrote on that subject. But before we get to President Obama's visit, Joe Klein, I wanted to visit with you about Syria. There have been reports in recent days that the place is certainly known to be awash with chemical weapons, but some might have been used. What do we know about that? Is there any truth to it as far as you can tell at this point? And if it's not happened yet, what are the likelihood that we'll see that kind of use in the future?
Well, thank you for having me, Frank. There are unconfirmed reports that chemical weapons were used in Syria. Those reports came out yesterday. The government and the opposition are pointing fingers at each other, but as yet those reports remain unconfirmed. However, the larger issue is that we know that there are chemical weapons floating around in Syria. Assad has been building up his chemical weapons stockpile for years, as well as a biological weapons capability. And what I'm afraid of is, and I think Israel is especially afraid of, is that those weapons will find their way to Hezbollah, to the Sunni fundamentalist jihadists that are increasingly making up the armed opposition to Assad. And that's going to be existentially dangerous to Israel, adding those kinds of weaponry to the rockets, for example, that Hezbollah has pointed at Tel Aviv and other major population centers.
Right. And of course, Joe Klein, the folks you've been talking about, particularly the Shiite folks, the Hezbollah group most especially, has been identified as having taken up positions. They're allied, of course, with Bashar Assad and his regime, having taken up positions in proximity to some of these chemical weapons caches and depots in Syria. So this is not simply a worst-case assessment. This is a distinct possibility, I would imagine.
Well, and you have two potential channels here. As you say, it could be a desperate move from the Assad regime and their remnants, if they find themselves on their backs, to hand off some of that weaponry to their allies, Hezbollah, or, of course, Iran itself, which is has a presence right now in Syria and can perhaps just take what it wants. The second channel, as I said, is the armed opposition, which is increasingly Islamist, fundamentalist, jihadist Sunnis, and they don't have the West's interests in mind either, except to destroy it, and Israel will be one of their first targets.
Indeed. A sobering backdrop, to say the least, for President Obama's visit to Israel. There is reason to believe that he would rather be focusing on other things, notably the Palestinian Israeli so-called peace process. Joe Klein, maybe we can come back to that in a moment. But how do you anticipate President Obama will deal with issues like Syria and, for that matter, Iran in the course of his travels with the Israelis in the next day or two?
Well, I think he's going to continue making his "we have your back" type of statements to Israeli leaders, and he's going to turn on a charm offensive in his speech to Israeli citizens, particularly the youth, which he'll be making. You know, he'll, I think, reiterate that there will be a red line over which, if Iran crosses, will take military action as one option. And he may well repeat his red line arguments and assertion with regard to chemical weapons in Syria. Red line is something that, of course, Prime Minister Netanyahu had used in his UN speech regarding the Iranian nuclear capability. Obama has used the same phrase, both with regard to Syria, a little bit less as far as Iran is concerned, although he says all options are on the table, and I think that is what he'll reiterate in his meetings with Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Peres. But Obama's very good at verbalizing that all options are on the table, but we haven't really seen him use all the options available.
Yeah, and needless to say, Israel must be increasingly frantic over the extent to which Iran is systematically approaching, if not stepping over those red lines. Talk to me a little bit about this so-called peace process, if you would. Again, our guest is Joseph Klein. He has written extensively on these subjects, notably in just recent days on the Front Page magazine site, about a man shaping Obama's strategy on Israel, Benjamin Rhodes. Who is that guy, and what impact is he having, and which course do you think the president will take on this peace process business?
Well, Benjamin Rhodes is a 35-year-old deputy national security advisor to Obama, who, according to the New York Times, really has Obama's ear and, in the words of the Times, channels Obama's foreign policy. Rhodes was the fellow who wrote that infamous speech that Obama delivered in Cairo in June of 2009, in which Obama essentially apologized to the Muslim world for all the West's alleged actions and evils in oppressing the Muslim world. And he also characterized Israel's presence in, quote, Palestine as a, quote, 60-year occupation. So with that in mind, and also Rhodes was one of the leading advisors to the president, urging him to throw Egyptian President Mubarak under the bus. We see where that's led to. We have a radical Islamist Muslim Brotherhood-led government there now. That's in many ways worse than Mubarak was. And now Rhodes is writing Obama's speech to the Israeli people. They're going to skip over Knesset. They're not going to. He's not going to address the Israeli parliament, Knesset. He's going to deliver one of his 2008 campaign-style speeches to young people, this time in Israel. And he'll make and Rhodes is with Obama on this trip. And interestingly, the Secretary of State, John Kerry, in Rhodes' words, will be, quote, accompanying us. So Kerry will just sort of be there smiling, and Rhodes will be the guy who, you know, whatever public statements we hear from Obama as part of his charm offensive and how there's a close bond between Israel and the United States and so forth, we know that the true thoughts were expressed in that Cairo speech where the occupation, in quotes, of Israel was characterized as lasting for, quote, 60 years, which delegitimizes Israel's very existence.
Yeah, among other outrageous provisions, as you point out in your piece at Front Page Magazine, Joe Klein, much is made also of the so-called historic tolerance of Islam and, of course, of Palestinian victimhood. Very quickly, in just a minute or so, if we have left, Joe Klein, to what extent do you think President Obama will try to bring real pressure to bear through these various gambits on the Benjamin Netanyahu government, now newly refashioned, to make further concessions to the Palestinians, and will it work?
I think that behind the scenes, in his private meetings with Netanyahu, there will be pressure brought to bear, because I think Obama sees Netanyahu as somewhat weakened in this new coalition government. It's moved somewhat more toward the center. And I think that Obama is going to perhaps link support, or at least a stated support for doing whatever is necessary to prevent Iran from getting a bomb, with some demonstration of more concessions by the Israelis on the Palestinian situation. And I think when Obama visits Palestinian Authority President Abbas tomorrow in Ramallah, he's going to try to deliver some promises that there'll be some more progress from the Israeli side.
We'll be watching it closely, as I know you will be, Joe Klein. Come back to us again very soon, if you would, and keep up the good work in the meantime at Front Page Magazine and elsewhere. Next up, we will speak with Elaine Donnelly about the latest manifestations of the Obama administration's wrecking operation against our U.S. military. Straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
My name is Sunday Hollis, and I totally lost the craving for sweets. I totally lost the craving for bread, even meat. And some people, you know, you would see people say, oh, well, you're eating a salad because you're trying to diet, but you just don't have a taste for any of the junk anymore. And it is so, so, so true. I'm thinking this is something that the celebrities are using. They're just not giving the meta system the credit for it. I've tried everything under the sun, and this is the only product that I have even called the company and asked them, could I sell it for them? This is a product where you can actually use the word awesome. I mean, and it is the whole essence of the word awesome.
Don't wait another minute to start losing weight. Call Judy Singer's The Meta System at 1-800-711-JUDY. That's 1-800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. One of my favorite colleagues and co-combatants in the war for the free world's military space is Elaine Donnelly. She is the founder and president of a marvelous organization, the Center for Military Readiness, truly one of the few institutions in the country that really understands and speaks so effectively for those serving our country in uniform and whose issues specifically with respect to the sort of social engineering are very poorly understood by almost all of the rest of us. So, Elaine Donnelly, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the wonderful introduction, too. And I feel privileged, really, to deal with the issues involving men and women in the military. I respect them so much and have learned so much about the culture of the armed forces over the years. And I've also seen political forces being brought to bear and media influence. A lot of criticism of the armed forces and highlighting problems that this is really ironic. Many of us have been involved in these issues for many years. When I was a member of the Presidential Commission on the assignment of women in the armed forces, and we looked at women in combat, and we warned of many of the problems that are being seen today. And unfortunately, the report and the recommendations we made were never heard by Congress. Congress hasn't had a hearing on women in combat in 34 years in the House, 22 years in the Senate, long overdue. But I'll tell you this, people who are pointing to problems now should not be the ones offering solutions to make those problems worse.
Yeah, I want to drill down.
Because many of them are due to their recommendations.
I couldn't agree with you more. Elaine Donnelly, let's drill down on some of those problems. National Public Radio has been running this week a series of very wrenching stories about how women in the military are having real difficulties. In one case, they were talking about the dislocation of their families as they are set off to war. In another piece today, they were talking about the, they say, rampant practice of sexual abuse of women. We have pregnancies, we have readiness issues, we have morale problems. And all of this, it seems, is taking more and more time of commanders and others in the military to manage. And yet, Elaine Donnelly, as you have been warning so effectively, they're trying to make it worse by putting these women into harm's way. Tell us what's up with that.
Well, let's take the issue of sexual assaults. They are totally out of control and increasing without limit. According to an Army report in 2001, the rates of sexual assault, and I'm talking violence here, not just looking at somebody funny, increased from 663 to 1,313, almost double. And they reported the rates are going up at the average of 14.6 per year. Department of Defense, their report showed a 22% increase since 2007. There is no end in sight. And yet here we hear the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, making the ridiculous argument that if we put women into direct ground combat, infantry battalions, the tip of the spear, special ops forces, Navy SEALs and the like, if we do that, there would be more respect for women. And somehow this would reduce these rates of sexual assault. We have not heard an argument like that. Remember the tailhook scandal when a lot of naval aviators, both men and women, partied wildly in Las Vegas. And Pat Schroeder made that argument. She said, well, we have to have women in combat aviation because then there'll be less assaults or harassment of women. 20-some years later, what has happened? Everything has gotten worse. That is not the answer. So if you look at these issues, sexual assault, and on the other end, what you mentioned about voluntary relationships leading to things like pregnancy and disruption in the rank, it affects cohesion. When a commanding officer is involved with a woman in the unit, both of them are to blame, by the way. It's not just the woman's fault. When you take all of those problems and you transfer them to the infantry, special operations forces, and the like, what have you got? You've got more problems, not less.
Right. Well,
and yet, General Martin Dempsey, I don't know why he said that.
Elaine, the issue is not simply problems that this inflicts upon the military, of course. It's the undermining of the military's performance. And that ought to be a matter of the utmost concern, especially for these senior military officers. And yet they have bought in lock, stock, and barrel, it appears, to this idea that, as you say, let's make it worse. Let's at least create more circumstances under which these kinds of tensions, these kinds of interactions are inevitable. Particularly in you know, very, very exposed ground combat sorts of circumstances where there's absolutely no privacy and lots of opportunity for very bad things to happen. And Elaine, I guess I really want to get at the larger question that occurs to me in all of this. As we listen to these reports, and you're right, there's a lot of blame to go around and serious issues that have arisen. But to the extent that a backstory, at least, if not a sort of leitmotif of all of these reports, is what's wrong with the military? Are we looking at the sort of discrediting and the taking down of one of the most, if not the most revered, and certainly one of the most, if not the most important institutions in the land?
That's right. That is the ultimate concern, because when you hear high-level officials following the lead of the president, President Obama is ultimately to blame for this, because he is endorsing, and the Pentagon has endorsed, the Military Leadership Diversity Commission report They're calling for diversity metrics, gender groups, what General Dempsey called significant cadres or critical mass of women. This is enlisted women we're talking about here. Involuntary assignments into formerly all-male units. Why? So that someday, somehow, there might be a female chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It's all about promotions to them. Well, here's two facts that I think are important. Women are promoted at rates equal to or faster than men. It has been that way for decades. There is no problem of discrimination against women because they are women in the military. But if General Dempsey thinks we need a new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff who is a woman, he should take off his stars, give his seat to an eligible woman, and let it go at that. Don't subject the enlisted women, many of them single mothers who signed up because of the medical benefits. They want to serve their country. They do not want to be treated like men. There is no evidence that they do. And yet, the military is racing ahead. They're following the orders of the president. They're trying to circumvent Congress. What's the answer to this problem? Congress. Congress has the constitutional authority to make policy for the military. They need to implement sound policy for women in the military and take into effect what we've learned over the last several years of war.
Let me just interrupt you for one second. Again, our guest is Elaine Donnelly. She is the president of the marvelous Center for Military Readiness and has been involved with these issues going back to the mid-1980s, I recall, when
That's
you were
right.
serving on the Defense Advisory Committee on Women in the Services, Dekowitz. Elaine, give us a specific example of what you think Congress should do now to try to alleviate this mm-hmm. problem and preserve the only military we have.
Right. Well, there's been talk about let's keep standards the same in the infantry and so on. That's not going to be enough because what you have to do is codify the policy put in place in 1993 and it's withstood the standard of time. We need to say very clearly that women are exempt from assignment to direct ground combat infantry, armor, artillery, and similar battalions, the ones that attack the enemy. That needs to be put into law. It has never been in law before because Congress trusted the Pentagon would never do that. If you do that, you take care of two other problems, selective service. Civilian women would have to sign up for selective service because the ACLU will go into court and they'll say this, Supreme Court, you said women could be exempt from selective service because they are not used as combat replacements in a war. That's changed. Now, women should be involved in selective service, and guess what? They win. That's a pretty sound bet, okay?
Even second point, real quick.
Exactly. The second point is standards. You don't need to have an elaborate system to try to treat women the same as men, which is impossible, if you keep those units all male.
Right.
The infantry corps is all male. It doesn't need to be gender normed. It must not be gender normed because the men will not get the same training they have now. Codification is the key.
And you will have women who are unable to do the job with men and therefore both exposed in the problem to the problems we've been talking about, Elaine Donnelly, and unable to perform mm-hmm. as they're needed in ground combat roles. Elaine Donnelly, I really appreciate your courage and your clarity on these issues and your help in exposing all the rest of us to the real problems and the need for real solutions. Keep up the good work at the Center for Military Readiness. We'll look
Thank
forward
you,
to
Frank.
Talking with you again very soon. Next up, Dr. Paul Kanger celebrates a couple of key anniversaries with us, Rocky Freedom and the SDI speech. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it. at www.letsmove.go. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. An accident yesterday involving a live fire exercise in Nevada caused the death of 7 U.S. Marines. Senate Majority Leader has been criticized for seemingly suggesting that the incident was the result of the latest round of sequestration budget cuts. Now, Harry Reid is not above cheap political shots, and he bears substantial responsibility for the massive and damaging reductions in defense spending that have been taking place over the past 4 years. The truth is that whatever the specific cause of this incident and the relationship, if any, it has to the underfunding of our armed forces, yesterday's tragedy is likely but an early indication of the huge costs in lives and treasure that we will bear for hollowing out the only military we have in an increasingly dangerous world. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being from time to time, by one of the nation's most eminent and, I think, thoughtful of historians. He is Dr. Paul Kengor. He is the executive director of the Grove City College's Center for Vision and Values. He also is a professor of political science there and the author of numerous really important works of history, including one of my personal favorites, The Crusader, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of Communism. Paul Kengor, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always great to have you with us.
Oh, it's always great to be with you, Frank. Thank you.
We have a couple of anniversaries this week that I'm interested in getting your historical perspective on. You've actually written about one of them already, the 10th anniversary of Iraqi freedom and where we are in the aftermath of those 10 long years of struggle.
It's a good question, Frank, and I get a lot of emails from people. I get, just last week, I got an email from a conservative friend just commenting on what a colossal mistake the Iraq War was. In fact, I probably get more emails from conservatives than I do liberals on the subject. But it's much more complicated. I mean, if the world is unquestionably better off without Saddam Hussein. And not just without Saddam Hussein, but without his two sons. Uday Ikuse, people don't think about that. I mean, you had there not just more years of Saddam Hussein, who actually wasn't that old and was in pretty good shape when he died, when he was executed, but you had these two young sons who were just, they may have been worse than him. I mean, look at the hereditary Kims in North Korea. They just seem to get worse. the latest Kim, you thought, well, this guy's probably not going to be as bad. This guy's saber-rattling even more than the other two in just a few months.
Indeed. This is a very important point, Paul Kinger, and one of the things that I think particularly is neglected in all of this is not just what these characters were like and their megalomaniacal ambitions and genocidal ambitions, for that matter, and their support for terrorism, but also the imminence at the time that the Iraq invasion took place of the complete unraveling of the sanctions that had exercised some measure of check on those ambitions. Bring that to mind, and what might have happened if those sanctions had come completely off.
Well, that's exactly right. In the end, people forget this, Frank, but the debate was not a matter of, did Saddam have WMDs? We all thought that he did. Everybody did.
Did have them, damn it. He had them, and he used them.
That's right.
This wasn't as though we were just, you know, making this up. It was a question of whether he still had something more than the knowledge of how to make more of them or use them in the future. That was a given, because he certainly had had them in the past. Excuse me, go ahead.
That's right. And the question, the debate was really over how to contain them. And you know, the Bush-Blair approach was, you need to remove the WMD threat by removing Saddam Hussein. Now, the other approach by, let's say, the Germans, the Russians, the French, the Chinese, was, let's wait out sanctions. And I mean, that, you know, that that was basically the split. It wasn't over whether he had them. It was how to contain them.
Well, but Paul, so, but just to keep a fine point on this, the Russians and the Chinese particularly, and others who had been bought off in Europe and elsewhere by Saddam Hussein's oil for food program, among other things, were actively working to take out those sanctions. It was it was a question of, by waiting him out, I guess you mean, really removing them and allowing him to survive.
That's exactly right. You know, they were urging us to use sanctions, and what they really meant by that was, don't invade. Let's continue to use sanctions, but really our plan is, that's what they were thinking, is they give us a year or two and we'll get rid of those sanctions completely. I mean, that's what they were trying to do. And so you would have today, 10 years later, a Saddam Hussein without sanctions, who would have ramped up. I mean, even David Kaye, when David Kaye went there and said, look, I found infrastructure and intent, intent to ramp up, to do what Saddam Hussein was doing before, the same infrastructure for the WMDs.
Including nuclear weapons, which he was interested in getting back in the business of.
So we'd be looking at a Saddam today, 10 years later, who would probably be ramping back up, would probably have a lot more, and he'd have a lot more money, because the coalition to hold sanctions together would have broken very quickly. He'd have a lot more money, and he'd have his two sons there. There'd be terrorists there. Now, you know, the one question that you and I always get from people is, but you know, was one American boy of the thousands that was killed over there worth the life of Saddam Hussein? Well, I don't think one American boy is worth the life of Hitler, is worth the life of Stalin, is worth the life of anybody. When it comes down to that, but you know, on the question of should this man have been removed? Is that something that our military should have done? I think so.
Paul, just again, we've got to keep this in perspective. Our men and women in uniform, God love them, have volunteered.
That's right.
To put their lives on the line so that an awful lot more of us may survive. And that's what I think you're getting at. That's what was at stake. A Saddam Hussein at large, unchecked by sanctions, backed by the Chinese and Russians, using his oil for food money and God only knows what else to execute his ambitions, would almost certainly have put an awful lot more Americans' lives at risk. But Paul, we're going to run out of time before we run out of historical reflection. Let me ask you, though, if I may, to quickly turn to another topic. You have, as I mentioned earlier, written definitive biographies of Ronald Reagan and his role I'd like to get you to talk about, if we have time, two things. First and foremost, this week is also the 30th anniversary of the famous SDI speech, the Strategic Defense Initiative speech. Tell us about its moment and what flowed from it.
Yeah, March 23rd, 1983. And by the way, Frank, that comes 15 days after March 8th, 1983, which was the date that Ronald Reagan called the Soviet Union an evil empire. So if you could imagine that 1-2 punch, 30 years ago this month, it really rattled the Soviet Union. You talk about a haymaker. But this was it was devastating to the Soviet Union because the Soviets themselves had been pursuing missile defense for years. And they knew the possibilities.
Despite the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty, which they negotiated.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, which liberals were invoking. And, you know, Al Gore, as late as the 2000 presidential debate, standing up there with George W. Bush saying we can't pursue missile defense because of the 1972 ABM treaty. The Soviets had been doing that for decades. And they knew that a nation like America with our technology, our dollar, our infrastructure, our money, our know-how and ingenuity, that if the Soviets could do what they were doing, then look out at what the United States could possibly do.
Right. It was a part of the competition, the larger strategy of taking these guys down that Reagan understood could really stress their system in a way that would be insuperably hard for them to deal with, right?
It was peace through strength. And this was a vital component of peace through strength. And by the way, the very next
a word
morning,
that Ronald Reagan made a household word, a term.
That's right.
I should say.
That's right. Reagan made that a household term. And the next morning, March 24th, 1983, a senator by the name of Ted Kennedy did the Soviets a gigantic favor when he went on the floor of the Senate and referred to SDI as Star Wars and ridiculed it as Star Wars Red Scare technology. Made fun of it, came up with this image of a Hollywood Ronald Reagan, fancying himself Luke Skywalker, taking on Darth Vader and the evil empire, and made fun of it. And the Soviets said, whew, okay, well, here at least we've got a propaganda item that we could use to try to attack us. So the Soviets picked up the term Star Wars.
Only one of countless contributions, I'm sorry to say, that Ted Kennedy and the radical left have given over the years
right.
to those that Ronald Reagan, thank God, successfully defeated. Paul Kinger, we don't have time to get to the other issue, which we'll ask you to come back to us on at some point soon. Ronald Reagan's interest in ridding the world of nuclear weapons, something that's endlessly used to justify President Obama's ambitions in that regard. I'm struck by the failure that we're now evidenced in Syria of an earlier effort to rid the world of chemical weapons.
Right.
But that will be another day's conversation with you. Dr. Paul Kinger of Grove City College, we appreciate so much your historical insights and analysis and the superb pedagogy you engage in at Grove City. Keep up the good work, too, and come back to us if you would soon.
Thank you, and your radio show and Center for Security Policy. You guys do great work.
Thank you. Diana West is up next. We'll talk with her about the visit of Lars Hedegaard to the United States in defense of free speech. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy to eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Metasystem from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Metasystem also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Metasystem, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Metasystem to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Metasystem by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Metasystem from Judy Singer, the powerful, all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. As ever, at this block of time in our weekly schedule, we have the privilege of visiting with our friend and colleague Diana West, not often in the flesh as we do today. She's here with us in studio, and we're delighted to see you as always, Diana. Welcome.
Thank you.
You are accompanying one of my personal heroes with whom we spoke earlier this week, Lars Hedegaard, in from Denmark. He's talking about freedom of speech. Tell us what he's worrying about and what we all should be worrying about in that department.
Well, yes. I've had the privilege of knowing Lars for about 5 years now. And it was just a month or so ago when he was nearly assassinated at his apartment, which we've discussed on the air before. And this trip, in a sense, is really almost a coming out party for him. He is here in America discussing freedom of speech in Europe and America and what it is like to have actually faced a gun at his apartment in his face and succeeded to tell the tale, live to tell the tale. Mm. The issues that he has been highlighting have a lot to do with the difficulties of really, in a sense, as I've been listening to him, what it is like to live under Sharia, what it is like to live under Sharia speech codes, which he, along with many of his countrymen, refused to do. And he, as a leading spokesman of simple freedom of speech, I mean, it's the most simple concept, it's the most dear concept to us. It is the concept most under fire at this point by the expansion of Islam into Europe and other Western countries, including ours, and what it is like to fight back and nearly be taken down for it. It really brings the issue home to us to realize that a newspaper editor, I mean, what are we talking about here? He writes things. He covers things. He tries to analyze things to the best of his abilities. He's a very good reporter. He's a historian. He's a careful journalist. And for this, we almost lost him. Mm-hmm. And the fear is, I think, and I think that even though we still have our Lars, there is a chilling effect mm-hmm. that is always sent with these efforts, successful or not. And that is the thing that we need to fight back about. And I've listening to his interviews in the States, as I've been able to do in the past few days, I do detect a great failure to comprehend how much Americans have acceded to these same speech codes. We, at this time, have not had the violence that our European cousins have had. We have not had the string of assassinations, thank God. We have not had the attempts. However, we have learned to acquiesce, to submit. And there is very little comprehension that this is going on. And when I notice people interviewing Lars, they're asked about it as though they're talking about conditions in a foreign...
Mars.
Well, it's happening here, folks.
Yes.
And you're absolutely right, Diana. And we had a marvelous program with Lars yesterday at the Heritage Foundation in which these issues were discussed. And the role of our own government in this acceding, as you say, to infringements on our freedom of speech. Interestingly enough, we'll have a report a little later in the week, folks, about a program that was done at Howard University last night, featuring an organization called Karama, which I'm told means dignity in Arabic, where an individual from the Muslim Law Students Association presented on the subject of limits of free speech in a global era. Does America's free speech model endanger Muslim Americans? And just talk a little bit about that notion that what we're dealing with here, Diana West, is a free speech model as opposed to an inalienable, God-given right enshrined in our Constitution.
Yes. Well, the fact is, in a sense, that title of the conference is entirely correct. Free speech does endanger Islam in the sense that it is a undergirding premise of Islam that it is not to be questioned, it is not to be exposed, it is not to be critiqued, it is not even to be discussed honestly.
Mm. Truthfully.
Truthfully, because this exposes it to ridicule or perhaps people will leave it. Indeed, recently we
had Karen.
Or resist it. And so in a sense, what they are discussing is entirely a natural reaction to free speech about Islam. In Islam, they have very strong, clear laws, Islamic laws, Sharia laws, ruling against apostasy. It is a capital crime. Mm. You are killed for apostasy, leaving Islam. Criticizing Islam is considered a form of apostasy. And there's any number of rulings and citations,
fatwas that
we can back this up with in terms of establishing its absolute mainstream roots in Islam, in traditional Islam, in Islam as it is practiced today.
Yeah. One of the other facets of this is an effort has been made by a terrific group called Former Muslims United to ask leaders, putative, self-appointed mostly, leaders of the Muslim American community to disassociate themselves from these notions that
the apostasy laws
must be enforced and people should be killed if they violate them.
It's the litmus test.
Scarcely any have done it.
Right.
Scarcely any.
That, I think, is the most important litmus test when you can actually discern whether a Muslim or other person who pretends to be a reformer of Islam is true or not, because you cannot possibly reform a totalitarian movement without removing the mechanism of the totalitarian movement, which is death for its traitors. Mm-hmm. It's those who wish to leave it, to criticize, don't want to be part of it. If you don't remove that penalty, there is no reform. And I think that we find it is a way of smoking out the honest reformer from the taqiya artist, from the practicer of deception and disinformation.
Yeah.
And it is absolutely the crux of the matter when there's any discussion of alliance, reform, any kind of, you know, compromise or accommodation. And people need to zero in on that. And we have our friend Lars, having been essentially sentenced by Islam to death for criticizing it, and the sentence was nearly carried out by someone who wished to enforce it.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Not just a problem on Mars,
right.
Not just a problem in Denmark, not just a problem in Europe or Canada for that matter, but very much a problem here in Dino West. Nobody tracks these and does a better job of helping illuminate them for us than you. We're delighted to have you with us. Let me ask you quickly about something else that you've written about this week in your weekly column, and you can find all of Diana's terrific writings at dianawest.net. Let me ask you specifically about a question you pose provocatively in your headline. Why does Obama need 1.6 billion bullets? Why, indeed?
I do not know. I do not know. And this is an example of a question that should be asked in the White House press corps. This should be asked when the president is walking to his helicopter. It should be asked of the Department of Homeland Security secretary. It should be asked of every possible Obama official. It does seem to be a true fact. It does seem to come out of the federal register, which is posted online. Even liberal groups are not denying the fact that there has been this extraordinary amassing of bullets and weapons and even these armored
vehicles, MRAPs they call them.
For domestic use, and it's certainly not being used on our border, which remains porous and open, and goodness knows what's going through.
Let me read what you say in your column in the first paragraph, Diana West, and that is something I've quoted before, but it can't be read often enough. In 2008, on the campaign trail, then-candidate Barack Obama said, quote, "We cannot continue to rely only on our military in order to achieve the national security objectives that we've set. We've got to have a civilian national security force that's just as powerful, just as strong, just as well funded as the military." So, Diana, we don't know the answer to the question, but
right.
It is indeed a pregnant question, one that demands repetition, as you say, in all of these venues, and not least, I would think, by oversight committees of the United States Congress.
Absolutely.
And we look forward to exploring such answers as we get out of those questions, if indeed they are posed. And I know that you will be posing them in any event, as will we be here at Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. As always, great to see you in person and to have the chance to visit with you here this week. We look forward to doing so again next, and to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow. Until then, this is Frank Abney. Thanks so much for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.